You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What really caused the Flint water crisis? The obvious and well-known answer is the April 2014 decision to begin drawing the city's drinking water from the Flint River. That, in turn, caused corrosion in the city's lead water pipes, and that caused lead to leach into people's drinking water. Others point to Governor Snyder's appointment of an emergency manager to control Flint's affairs. That happened in late 2011. But Michigan State University public health expert and urban geographer Rick Sadler argues the true cause of Flint's water disaster goes back decades. Sadler and co-author Andrew Highsmith have published a study that lays out their case in the journal Environmental Justice. Rick Sadler, welcome back to Stateside.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
What are we missing, Rick, when we lay blame at the emergency manager appointment or the switch to the Flint River?
Yes, when we look at those, we're looking at the outcomes of a whole bunch of policy decisions. And so we're missing the bigger picture of state policy that supported suburbanization for many decades and made it easier for suburbs to prevent cities from annexing the developments that sprung up on their properties in the post-war era. And so as our cities continued growing, it meant that the internal, like the core cities, weren't able to capture the tax base that was growing beyond their boundaries. And so as people moved out and out, it meant that cities increasingly became places where poverty was concentrated, where there were fewer jobs, where educational systems started declining, and the state propped up this system by encouraging suburban movement.
I love a quote of yours that I read where you talk about these series of policies that made it easy for people to go frolicking off into the farmland and ignore the infrastructure that was already built. But you really did put it well. That's what was happening when we're talking about the 50s and the 60s.
Yeah, and I admit that's a little hyperbolic, but it's effectively what we've been able to do. And don't get me wrong, I don't hate on suburbs, but the problem I have is that we as a society don't pay the fair price of living in those suburbs. There's a lot of invisible subsidies from freeway construction to new infrastructure construction to the FHA loans that our families got to move out to the suburbs. And people don't really realize that if they live out in, you know, in a cornfield somewhere or out in a suburb, they're getting a bigger chunk of government subsidy than somebody who lives in a city.
And here, as you say, the infrastructure is already there in the city, but then it becomes ignored and untended to as we see population and dollars leave that city.
Yeah, and that's why I say, frankly, you know, I don't think of this as a political issue, but I think that building denser cities is fiscally conservative because it's supporting the development that doesn't increase public infrastructure spending. It doesn't mean that the government's going to try to force us all to live into Soviet-style apartment blocks. It means that we're taking responsibility for the infrastructure that we've already built.
Rick, tell us about this economist who promoted this urban development model that, as you point out in your study, really hurt Flint.
Yeah, so it's called the Tybout model. And the basic premise, and this was developed back in the 40s, 50s, it assumes that regions are better off when municipalities can compete with one another for tax base, which in theory isn't a bad thing. You know, it can make sense. It can work in certain situations. But the problem is that nobody wants the impoverished populations, the elderly populations, racial minorities, and so it doesn't deal with the social equity problem. And so for Tybout, in his time, the question wasn't about civil rights and social justice and so forth, and it just didn't really pop up. You know, he's thinking, how can governments be more efficient? Well, they can be efficient by competing with one another, and you get the same kind of idea with proposals to amend the health care law. You know, more competition will make it more efficient.
Or school of choice, even, when we think about
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Yeah, in some cases, these kinds of proposals are more or less attractive. But again, because we don't deal with the social justice problem, it means that the populations who are from poorer populations or from racial minorities wind up concentrated in one municipality. There's, you know, zoning laws that can be passed that kind of implicitly exclude affordable housing and different housing types that segment the population not only by race but also by class. And then the problem with this is that research has shown again and again that these fragmented regions are places where there are greater health and educational inequalities between races and classes.
So what Charles Tybout, the economist and geographer who came up with this in the 1940s, that idea just built and built and then came down like a landslide on Flint.
Right, yeah. And I don't think that he would have predicted that Flint's economic decline would have been as severe as it was either. I mean, a lot of people back then were concerned that Flint had no economic diversification. It was like the least economically diverse city in the country back in the 60s.
It was a company town.
Yeah, exactly. But I think people just assumed that it would keep growing. And as long as Flint was growing, it didn't matter so much, city, suburb, you know, everybody had a bit of a slice of the pie. But then as the pie started getting shrunk a bit, meant that there were increasingly winners and losers in that, they call it like municipal Darwinism, you know, the competition between municipalities.
There's still an inclination to want a culprit, to blame someone. Who do you think, Rick, that someone should be? Is it the people who picked up and left the city decades ago, or the policymakers, or something else?
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't blame the individuals who left. It is hard. It's hard to find a specific culprit. But, you know, you look at the individuals who left, the individual family was just seeking better schools or safer neighborhoods, bigger yards, lower taxes. Like, there's lots of decent, honorable reasons that people wanted to suburbanize. It's the whole American dream thing. Like you say, we have to look at the policies that were designed to promote and subsidize the suburban living at the expense of cities. So, you know, if we're going to look at who to blame, it's kind of a hard question, but I guess I would just look at, okay, we collectively screwed up, our policies screwed up, and so what can we do now to address that? And that means more pro-urban policies. It means making the subsidies that the suburbs get more plain, like making it more apparent that these are places that are less efficient in delivering infrastructure and are spending more of the public dollar on roads.
And do you believe the public and political will is there to do exactly that, to kind of rethink policies about our big cities? Because I'm sure this is a story that is not just confined to Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where we run into another linchpin, because I don't think there's a lot of political will to talk seriously about this, because there is still such a perception that suburbs are somehow distinct from and absolved from responsibility from their core cities. You know, even looking at a more recent policy change in the last 15 years or so, where the state of Michigan changed their revenue sharing structure. And so cities have lost out on millions and millions of dollars that the state previously would have sent back to them from taxes. And the Detroit News has written about this, and others have started talking about this. The Michigan Municipal League has a campaign right now called the Save My City series. It basically amounts to the fact that if the state of Michigan hadn't cut revenue sharing, the amount of money that Flint would have received over the past 15 years or so would have been way more than their debt when the emergency manager was installed. So effectively, just even on that more proximate cause of the crisis, Flint never would have had an emergency manager if Michigan hadn't cut the revenue sharing. And that at least is some form of policy that reflects regional understanding, you know, a need for there to be regional collaboration.
How do you sell that message to the policymakers in Lansing is the big question.
Yeah, I mean, I would kind of frame it like, and I use that the kicker in the article that appears on MSU Today, I think it's in there. There's that old Flint City Commissioner saying, those of you who feel you'll escape by running to suburbia, beware, because blight recognizes no border lines. And I think that is important, because we're starting to see increases in inner suburban poverty and, you know, declines of educational and infrastructural systems in our inner suburbs. And so it would be foolish to assume that, you know, oh, well, I live in an outer suburb, it could never happen to me. You know, if it happened in Detroit and Flint, and then it happened in, you know, inner suburbs, Royal Oak, Southfield, Burton, Flint Township, there's no reason to believe that the cyclical process of urban development couldn't eventually affect places that are less efficient and lower density and provide infrastructure at a higher cost.
Rick Sadler, Michigan State University urban geographer and assistant professor of public health. His study, along with co-author Andrew Highsmith, can be found in the journal Environmental Justice. Great to talk with you, Rick. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.